Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
In previous podcasts, we've examined the topics of Christian stereotypes and the growing God gap in American politics. As to the former, Brad Wright took us through a list of stereotypes that people have about evangelical Christians and why they were often incorrect. And Jonathan Shields talked about his research showing that the Christian right, rather than fomenting intense partisanship, has actually been facilitating civic participation and civil dialogue. As for the role of religion in American politics, we had the pleasure of hearing from Corwin Schmidt, who detailed the growing political divide between those who are actively engaged in religious practice and people who are more secular in their outlook and behavior. David Brody, a reporter from the Christian Broadcasting Network, gave us his impression of how this religious divide played a role in the 2010 midterm elections. On today's episode, we will revisit some of these themes, but with a slightly different focus on how the media has portrayed fundamentalists. We'll also talk about the growing religious gap in American politics and, perhaps most interestingly, how media portrayals of fundamentalist Christians affect what we might call sophisticated or elite opinion. That is, the images of fundamentalist Christians held by individuals who are most attentive to the news media. This may include college professors, media pundits, Hollywood producers, or anyone who is a frequent consumer of the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, or other national news outlets of that variety. Our guest today is Louis Bolce, and he has been studying the growing religion gap, media portrayals of religion in American politics, and how that has affected elite and mass opinion over the course of the past several decades. Louis, along with his frequent co-author Gerald DeMaio, has written several dozen articles and book chapters on this topic and currently serves as an associate professor of political science at Baruch College, part of the City University of New York. Louis, welcome to Research on Religion.
Oh, hi, Tony. How you doing?
Doing very well. I want to spend our time today discussing what I consider to be one of the most fascinating aspects of your broad research agenda, and that is how the news media shapes what you called sophisticated or perhaps elite opinion regarding fundamentalist Christians. But before we get there, though, I think we need to address a few basic definitions here and also fill in some of the backstory of why fundamentalists have grabbed the attention of the news media recently. This backstory is going to take us into another segment of your research that investigates the growing divide between religious and secular voters in the U.S. So let's go down that path first and start our journey with a few basic definitional distinctions that you consider crucial to your research. The most important of these definitional issues relates to what constitutes a fundamentalist Christian in terms of your research, and also what constitutes a fundamentalist Christian in the eyes of elite opinion makers and sophisticated media consumers. So what can you tell us about that?
Okay, that's a very good point of distinction. How social scientists define evangelical and fundamentalist Christians for their research purposes and what the media and most educated non-evangelicals have in mind when they think about evangelical or Christian fundamentalists are entirely different matters. Now, by Christian fundamentalists, we're referring to a subset of individuals that subset of a broader evangelical community, about a third. These are individuals who adhere to traditional tenets of Orthodox Christianity. They have had an adult born-again experience. They hold to a literalist interpretation of Scripture. You know, they believe that the Bible is the literal word of God, and are people who display a suspicion, a reluctance to embrace modernity. Now, The data sets that we use, the NES, doesn't allow us to capture all, you know, everything about it that we would like to separate, say, fundamentalists from evangelicals, but it does contain a number of items that helps us to identify fundamentalists and evangelicals. And what we use the national election surveys that are conducted by the University of Michigan, and they're distributed through the Inter-University Consortium of Political Research.
And those are pretty extensive data sets, if
I'm
correct.
Yeah, since the 1980s, they have added a larger number of religious items that to get at the nuances of religion. They include a religious identity item, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, other, but also they ask about church membership, whether or not individual could check off that he's a Southern member of the Southern Baptist Convention or Assemblies of God. So they ask questions like that, that you can begin to group individuals into a larger evangelical framework that, or what others, social scientists group into evangelical faith tradition. We borrow a lot from Corin Smith's classifications, but they also ask about attitude toward Bible, how frequently a person will attend church, how often they pray, daily, more than daily, up to never, or not up, but I guess down to never.
Right.
How often they read the Bible, whether or not they've had a born-again experience, how important religion is. And we use these items also to help classify respondents who don't identify with a particular church but are lumped into a larger non-denominational clustering. So we can, we'll take into Christian, they're called non-denominational Christians, which is a fairly large group.
Right.
Of individuals, so we will look at their attitudes to the Bible, how often they attend church, and so on, and we can sort them into evangelical and fundamentalist.
So that is how you're defining fundamentalist Christian. And again, you're going pretty standard with the literature on fundamentalist Christians and the sociology of religion and such. But what about how the elite opinion makers view fundamentalism? Because what you are doing is you're studying how people who write for the New York Times and then people who read the New York Times view fundamentalists. How do they view fundamentalism?
Well, in a nutshell, it would probably be overly religious Protestants, but they don't use any religious definition of a fundamentalist or evangelical. For one thing, they lump the two, or they use the term evangelical and fundamentalist as more or less interchangeably. So they jump back and forth between them, and it's kind of just like it's a handy label, or it means an evangelical or a fundamentalist is an individual who's a conservative Protestant or conservative Christian who's morally disposed to pose raise objections to abortion, gay marriage, euthanasia, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they define, to a large extent, they're defined politically, not religiously.
So that's an interesting thing, because in your research, you make a distinction between what we would consider to be the Christian right, and that might include the Moral Majority and the Christian Coalition when they were around, and fundamentalists. Those two things are not necessarily the same, but that's not necessarily how elite opinion makers see it. Is that correct?
We define, for one thing, evangelical churches didn't initially, the Baptist Church or your church, or whatever church you belong to, or the Assemblies of God did not initially set up to form a political action group or to file amicus curiae briefs or to contest elections. They formed as faith communities. The Christian right organizations, we define them, or what we mean by them, are religious-based interest groups, or political interest groups, such as the Christian Coalition Focus on the Family, that are organized or mobilized against, or they're out to espouse certain traditional values like opposition to abortion and gay marriage. So they're oriented toward public policy, where churches are oriented toward faith, that's a big difference, politics and bringing people to Jesus.
And so it would probably be fairly difficult to say that all fundamentalists are involved in the Christian right, and there's not a one-to-one correlation there that we see in the data.
No, but there isn't. Okay, there again, there's a one-to-one correlation in the mind, or not one-to-one, but to use a technical term, there was about a 0.80 correlation coefficient between, you know, this is among people who read, who are very attentive to media, the correlation between their feelings toward Christian fundamentalists and, say, the Christian coalition, the coefficient, the correlation is about is 0.80. So you square that, you have 0.64 as an R square, and they're virtually, you know, that's a pretty strong correlation for social scientists.
Yeah.
But the thing is that research by individuals like Christian Smith and others have found that maybe when asked half of theologically traditional Protestants have never heard of these organizations and most don't support all their policies. It's not to say that there's, that traditional Christians aren't opposed to abortion or gay marriage and things like that, but they don't accept the full agenda. They're not identical.
Yeah. That's one of the things that we discovered in our earlier podcast with Jonathan Shields, that when talking about the moral majority in the 1980s, there was this image that, you know, if you were a fundamentalist Christian, you subscribed to the moral majority's position on everything. But the moral majority was fairly limited to the Southern Baptist Convention and even a small segment within that group that was relatively again, as I say, limited in terms of what it is. It certainly doesn't represent all fundamentalists.
What confused many of, in the political press during in 1988 was when Pat Robertson was running for the Republican nomination, and Jerry Falwell came out against him. They couldn't understand it. How could a fundamentalist, you know, fundamentalist Falwell, come out in opposition to, quote, the fundamentalist, Pat Robertson, who in fact was, what, a Pentecostal or charismatic, belongs to that wing of traditional conservative Protestantism.
Yeah, probably think it. Don't all those people think the same?
So the confusion was, is why wouldn't fundamentalists support fundamentalists?
That's kind of an interesting statement. And this leads us here then into our view of how the media looks at fundamentalists. And in a number of your research papers, you note that the news media tends to have a stereotypical caricature of the typical fundamentalist Christian. We covered some of that ground, as I mentioned earlier, with podcasts by Brad Wright and John Shields. But what's your impression of the stereotypical image in the media? How's the media looking at?
Well, generally fairly negative. For one thing, some studies have shown of newspaper editors and news producers and journalists have shown that the elite press, anyway, tends to think that very religious people are intolerant. So they're going to be concerned. They see them as threats to norms of democratic civility. So they're on the lookout to watch for activities, political activities of groups that they see as connected or associated with the evangelical or Christian fundamentalist community, and they see them as threatening. And one of the problems with their coverage is they tend to focus on and cover it from the top down. So they'll take they'll look at some prominent televangelist or a person who claims to be a spokesperson for the Christian right organization. And then they assume that everything this person says and the policies this person supports, the political style of that person, is the same as the policy views and the style and so on of who they presume, the people who they presume to be listening to these individuals or who these individuals are speaking for. So when for many people, if they think of a Christian fundamentalist, the first thing to pop in their mind is some televangelist, railing against some, group of abortion or gays or this or that. They tend to take individuals who also that tend to they single out individuals who have certain at certain times are displaying certain outrageous characteristics, and then they kind of conflate that with the broad brush of calling these evangelical.
Yeah, you make a really good point of that, because I think that if the media has a certain template of what they look like, they have big hair or what they say, they're going to blame Hurricane Katrina on sin in America or something like that.
We're going down that path.
Yeah, they go find those individuals in the news media, but then when they meet somebody on the street who's your average businessman and talking with them, say, oh, you're a fine person here, you sell t-shirts and that, and then find out that they're fundamentalists, that probably doesn't necessarily square in their head that those two things could go together.
A journalist named Mark Pinsky wrote a piece for Columbia about this problem. He said, in effect, he said that most of his knowledge of fundamentalists, and well, he was focused on on evangelicals, was based on his coverage of televangelists and spokespersons for Christian right organizations. Again, based on the presumption that what these people enable them to get into the heads of their viewers, or people that listen to them. But he moved to a community that happened to have a large number of evangelicals, and he bumped into them in the grocery stores or at the PTAs, and he got these were ordinary evangelicals, and he got an entirely different impression of evangelicals from what he based on his reporting and from reading the news reports of other people. And his basically, when he got to meet ordinary evangelicals and fundamentalists, he had very positive things to say, and he felt kind of ashamed that his whole former his knowledge of them was based on stereotypes.
Now, in terms of those stereotypes, we were talking that stereotype is that these fundamentalists are very intolerant toward other individuals, other groups in society. But you've investigated to what extent some of those stereotypes are true using a lot of different survey data. What have you found there?
Well, historically, fundamentalists and again, evangelicals are lumped together and in the media. And a lot of the studies, the social science studies, just studies the larger evangelical community. I'm going to tend to lump evangelical and fundamentalists, even though some of my findings are just on fundamentalists. But in the past, they've been associated being anti-black, anti-Jewish, anti-Catholic. In the press, and during the 2000 presidential race, the fundamentalists were accused of being anti-Catholic, and the press reported a lot of this. The Bob Jones incident when Bush went down there to South Carolina. But what we found is that fundamentalists tend to have a very positive attitudes towards Jews. We use thermometer scores. These are the ANES feeling thermometers allow individuals to rate individuals in groups on a scale from zero, meaning extremely cold or you hate them, up to 100. You love them or you feel very positive or warm, and a 50 is rather neutral. And we found that the fundamentalists rated Jews very positively, more so higher, or it felt warmer to them than many other religious groups. Mainline Protestants felt toward Jews and so on. Felt very positive to Catholics, blacks, and so on. So that was whatever might have been true in the past is not true in the data today. Also, other studies have found that they tend to, in the past, whatever their views or attitudes on the race issue was, we found that they have very favorable attitudes towards blacks, but they tend to be anti-racist. So of all the groups, both the religious groups, the fundamentalists tend to be the most anti-racist of the group.
One of the most interesting findings that in reading your paper was that a question was asked in the surveys, would you allow a racist to teach in the public schools? And how did fundamentalists view that question relative to other groupings in society?
Well, they were more likely to be negative against that.
Yeah, they didn't want a racist teaching in the public school.
No, they didn't want a racist teaching their children. And interesting enough, some of the people who conduct these studies might consider that an intolerant attitude.
Yeah.
They came out more likely in other groups to be opposed to overt racist teaching small school children. Other studies show that when they look at the theologically conservative Protestants as husbands and fathers and compare them with mainline Protestants and members of other religious groups and traditions, found that they, I'm talking about Brad Wilcox's research now, they come off as, or they found them to be better husbands, better fathers. They tend to be more loving and affectionate according to how they scored on these scales and indices. They spent more time socializing with their children. They were less likely to be involved in domestic violence against their wives. And their wives, the wives of these, quote, soft patriots, that's, or patriarchs, mm-hmm. That's what Wilcox calls them, their wives tended to be much more happier.
Yeah.
Felt they, indicate they had happier marriages, or come off scoring as happier in their marriage as than the wives of people in some of the other faith traditions, especially seculars.
Yeah, that's you mentioned Brad's research, and we're trying to get him onto the show. So, Brad, if you're listening, you give me a call. But yeah, his book was called "Soft Patriarchs," not "Soft Patriots." The soft patriots were the folks that the New York Jets beat a week or so ago.
Yeah, I corrected. I guess you didn't. I tried to correct myself.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking because I'm a big football fan, and we just recently had a podcast on religion in the NFL.
Last night.
So, speaking, I want to just spend a little bit more time in there because, as you mentioned, fundamentalists tend to have very warm thermometer readings toward Jews and toward other groups. How are the readings, the thermometer readings of Jews toward fundamentalists or Catholics toward them?
That's a good point, and there's a certain irony there. Let me get one other point, too. We found that fundamentalists had far warmer feelings. Now Lieberman ran with Gore against Bush in 2000, and Lieberman's Jewish and Gore was a Baptist. And we looked at fundamentalist evaluations of Lieberman and Gore, of those who knew that Lieberman was Jewish and Gore was a Baptist, and fundamentalist evaluations of Lieberman were significantly more positive by like 15 or so degrees on the thermometer than they were toward Gore. So that's it was another interesting kind of finding, even though both were, tended to be with a party that many fundamentalists opposed in that election. But Jews tend to have extremely negative attitudes towards evangelicals and Christian fundamentalists. On a thermometer of 100 points, they might average around 30 degrees, below freezing.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, which is kind of ironic because one is the positive feelings that fundamentalists and evangelicals have toward Jews, but in terms of policies, they tend to be, evangelicals, fundamentalists tend to be the most supportive of Israel, mm-hmm. of the state of Israel, which is a very important concern for most Jews in this country. So, you have extremely negative, but here's another thing, too, which is interesting, that traditional, Jews historically have been associated, one, with the Democratic Party, two, as being liberal, mm-hmm. Three, as favoring policies that, or take a liberal position on the social issues, like being pro-choice on abortion and very favorable toward gay marriage. What we did was we wanted to look at, well, how do people hold the opposite opinions, being conservative, right. Anti-abortion, anti-gay marriage, and so on, feel toward Jews, and it tended to, the bombers like in the 80s.
Wow.
But if you take people who are pro-choice, pro-gay marriage, liberal and Democrat toward evangelicals and fundamentalists, they tend to be like in the 20s or 30s in the thermometer. So there's definite political animus directed toward evangelicals and fundamentalists, but Jews do not conjure up any type of partisan image, I think, or ideological image in the public, despite the fact they've been involved in the kind of the liberal secular wing of the culture wars, mm-hmm. or side of the culture wars, or if people do, or if conservatives or traditionalists do, are aware of it, it just doesn't matter in their evaluations. But the political animus is directed toward the traditionalist side. So we tend to, we explain that as basically a media phenomenon.
Now, you mentioned a little bit here about the Democrat and Republican parties here, and that's the path I want to move us on that road now. And to a great extent, there's this notion that fundamentalist Christians, particularly fundamentalist white Christians, tend to favor the Republican Party when it comes to elections. And again, we had Corwin Smith talking about this on our program a couple months back. Have you seen a growing difference between religious and secular voters over time in the data that you're using? And how does this map out onto fundamentalists in particular?
Yes, there's big differences in how traditionally religious people vote compared to seculars. I'll get back to that, but you mentioned a good point, white theologically conservative Christians or white fundamentalists or white evangelicals, because the new religious divide, and I think that's what we're getting into right now, the religion gap, which kind of burst open in the electorate in the 1992 election, that is predominantly a white phenomena. Blacks hold, blacks tend to be more religious on average than a typical white person, and
right.
hold culturally conservative positions on abortion and gay marriage and favor kind of a vigorous role of religion in public life, but are very much, for other reasons, non-cultural reasons, very strongly supportive of the Democratic Party. So the religion gap is predominantly a white phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
But what we found is that the first stirrings of the culture of the religion gap probably occurred during the 1972 election, and some link it to the McGovern-Frazier reform to kind of in terms of allowing for greater participation of ordinary Democrats in the nomination and platform construction process within the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And those reforms, during the 1970s and late 60s were very turbulent years, and during that, what the result was of these reforms was that the Democratic Convention in 1972 was comprised of a very, a large number of people that were non-religious or secular, and that presented some conflicts within the Democratic Party at that convention, where you had individuals comprising the more traditionalist, maybe pro-labor or traditionalist wing of the Democratic Party, the old New Deal Democrats, Daley and some Southern evangelicals,
right.
In conflict with the New Left or the amateur Democrats that have come in supporting McGovern. And what that did, so you had kind of a miniature or a little religious divide that first took place within the Democratic Party, and then as a result of that, Democratic Party began to become associated, at least from active members in politics, as kind of unfriendly to religious, traditionally religious people. And by default, the Republican Party some of these people went to the Republican Party, and over time, the Republican Party, which was not all that more, wasn't any more religious than the Democratic Party, it was basically with mainline Protestants, was their core base, became identified as a religion-friendly party. And as Republicans became party, at the activist elite level, became ID'd as a more religion-friendly party. I'm not talking about the electorate yet, but among activists, then that the more secular elements within the Republican Party didn't feel as comfortable, and they withdrew from the Republican Party activism, or went over to, or individuals that might have been inclined to support the Republican Party at the, you know, in that, in terms of activism, went toward the Democratic Party. So you have 1972 at the elite activist level, and finally it works itself into the elected, where it bursts open in 1992, where during that election you had two-thirds of seculars supporting Clinton and two-thirds of religiously traditional voters voting for Bush. And that was a big switch since 1988, too, for the secular side.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. I mean, I'm thinking about this, how, you know, as you mentioned, in 1972, you start to see the influx of secular influences within the Democratic Party overtly. But what's interesting, I'm thinking about the 1976 election of Jimmy Carter, who was a born-again Christian, or basically said he was. That probably stunted some of this division and the God gap.
And Lehman shows that in his book, where there was a drop-off in the number of seculars at the delegate activist level. And even in 88, there wasn't. The upturn again came up into 1992.
Yeah.
At that convention. What was interesting, NES did a study of the attitudes, you know, the political policy positions and political attitudes of delegates at the Democratic Republican convention, and the average thermometer rating of Christian fundamentalists by Democratic delegates at the Democratic convention was 13 degrees.
Wow, that's very cold.
Yeah, I mean, and over half rated them as zero. Now, can you imagine that? Now, that is something that I didn't find out till much later. Now, you might get a sense of that if you really pay attention to news. You kind of dig it out, what's going on. But can you imagine if the Republic, if it was discovered by the press that the Republican Party, the average delegate at the Republican Party, had a 13-degree thermometer rating of blacks or Jews. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would have been broadcast all over the world.
Yeah, that's interesting. It brings up the issue of how the media views this. And, you know, I'm thinking back to the 1992 election. I'm even going back to 1988 and such. The big news in the media was this thing about the gender gap, that there was a growing gender gap between Republicans and Democrats, is that more women were favoring the Democrats, men were tending to drift over to the Republicans. How does the religious gap compare to the gender gap? Was the gender gap a lot bigger during that period of time?
Well, and therefore it received a lot more coverage? No, it was trivial compared to, and it's always been trivial when compared to the religion gap. You know, it's, now I think, you know, the religion gap, you know, which is the tendency of women to, you know, since the 1980s to Reagan era, I guess it's pegged, but it's, the 1996 was the election where it first became significant as in the electorate, a significant divide where you have religion preferring the Democratic Party and men supporting the Republican Party, and then it remained significant thereafter. Mm-hmm. But the average gap among women in the electorate is about, the gender gap was about 7 points, where women were 7 points more likely to support the Democratic Party than the Republican Party.
And how did that compare to religion?
The religion gap, the average gap was about 40 points.
Mm-hmm.
A 40-point difference. And, you know, gender gap can be considered, might be considered electorally significant in this way. Women are more likely, they comprise a larger share of the electorate than men, about 55-45. So in a really close election, presidential election in some states, maybe your state or others, if there was a close election, or you say Iowa or whatever, and if women, you know, if there was a pro-women tilt, you know, Democratic tilt among women in that election, it could swing that state over to the Democratic Party. But in terms of the larger significance, in terms of electoral politics, the religion gap is much bigger, and, you know, it's the most important cleavage in the electorate. You know, it's far more important, and cuts deeper than the class, region.
Probably the only thing different is race.
Things like, except race.
Yeah.
But it's far more, so it's, it cuts more deeply, and it's politically more important in this sense, that it has a greater potential for society, larger scale societal polarization,
because
it's connected to religious values
and
deep-seated moral values. And thirdly, it's historically is really significant. Never in the history of America have the two parties been an important feature of party conflict has been connected, associated with this type of religious divide, where you have a conflict between a secular modernist worldview versus a religious worldview informed by traditional Judeo-Christian moral tenets and so on. So that's something historically new, and you would think that the press would jump on this because of the high emphasis they place on novelty and conflict, but they ignore, what they tend to ignore is the secular aspect of this divide, or the role of seculars as political actors.
Now let me ask you about the media's attention to this, because what you have noted in your research, and I've been doing some work on this, and a number of other people have as well, is that this religious gap has been growing since 1992. But again, a lot of the attention was played during the 1990s to the gender gap. So why do you think the media really missed the boat on this? So you actually do a really neat content analysis of looking at the gender gap. And if you could tell us a little bit about, the religious gap. If you could tell us a little bit about how the media covered this religious gap and when it finally, quote unquote, discovered it, and maybe speculate why they were quite slow in picking this up. That'd be great.
In studying this, we did a LexisNexis search using of stories that appeared in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and we use those because they tend, for many people, news organizations, they set the agenda of what is news. So we thought it was okay to base our analysis on stories that appeared in the pages of those papers. And so we came up with about 100 different ways you could operationalize how the press could cover the secular religious divide in the electorate, like unbeliever and Democrat versus believer and Republican, or religion gap, or fundamentalist and evangelical, or Christian right, or religious right, or devout, blah, 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 and Republican, and then in paren, secular or secularist, unchurched. We tried to get at this as many ways as possible so we wouldn't leave out any stories. And so we looked at, we were interested in, social scientists have discovered this, have been writing about this religion gap. What about the press? What would the public have learned from the news media about this most significant cleavage in the electorate that has appeared? And they would have learned nothing until around the 2004 election. What they would have learned about, they would have read a lot of stories about the evangelicals and fundamentalists, or conflicts within the Republican Party between the Christian conservative wing and moderate Republicans. So you would have learned about that, but in contests over the machinery of the Republican Party and the future direction of the Republican Party. But you wouldn't have heard anything about the clash of worldviews that are driving the conflict between the Republican and Democratic Party, and fights over how our country should be guided in terms of public policy, and that you would have heard not a thing until the 2004 election. So the big coverage would have been on fights within the Republican Party, or the mobilization of evangelicals via the Christian right and using the Republican Party as an instrument to impose their policy agenda on the rest of the country.
Yeah, I was really quite surprised in I was really kind of surprised in your research, looking at your content analysis, to see the media coverage of this religious gap really pretty flat throughout the 1990s, and as you say, in 2004 spiked up.
It popped up in 2004.
It's an amazing spike that you show, and very comprehensive what you do with the LexisNexis search. And for me, that's really interesting, because as an academic who's been studying this for a couple decades, that the religious gap was always around me. I'd be reading, you know, books by Corwin Smith and others saying, whoa, this
is happening.
So you're
aware of it. I mean, let me just ask you a question real quick. Did it ever dawn on you why it wasn't reported in the press? Or were you aware that it wasn't reported?
That's a great question. And I'm kind of self-reflecting back on this now. And I guess I never really thought about it, because for me, it was something that I knew. And then I didn't see it in the press, but in the back of my head, it was always going on. So I never paid attention to it. And I think that in part that is a lot of how sophisticated opinion happens. If you're exposed to it a lot, you don't see it somewhere else. You never notice it when you don't see it somewhere else.
That's what Larry Iacone mentioned to me at a conference. He read a piece Jerry and I did in the Public Interest, and he said that what struck him was, wow, he was aware of this all this time, but it just struck him how that, you know, that it never was reported on, and he said it's so, you know, he was just struck by how could something like this, which seems so obvious to most educated people, you know, who follow this,
right,
be totally ignored.
No, it dumbfounded me too, and I guess it pointed to one of my blind spots too that I have in terms of the media. I want to just address one kind of little side note related to the coverage of the God gap and this spike around 2004, 2005 in the media coverage that you noted. I think right after that, a number of people started thinking about this in ways of, well, there is this, you know, problem with the Democratic Party. They're not reaching out to religious voters. And Amy Sullivan wrote a book at that time called The Closing of the God Gap, or something of that ilk. Has, since 2004, has that God Gap closed? Have Democrats reading the news?
No, it's bigger. But, you know, naturally, you know, the thing was is that the exit poll results in 2004 and the media reporting on it kind of frightened the some of the operatives within the Democratic Party. You had guys like Al Fromm saying, you know, you can't have a situation where you get all people that go to church vote Republican. You know, and there was a discussion to try to get the Democratic Party to become more religion friendly, you know, to speak, try to reconnect with the people in the pews, and to maybe recruit more religion friendly candidates like Heath Shuler from North Carolina and some of the Ellsworth from I think Indiana or whatever. Well, anyway, so there was that. The Democrats were concerned, and they wanted to, and they knew that they couldn't, at least in the short term, lose overwhelmingly the religious vote.
Yeah.
What we found, just go in and look at the exit poll results of attendance, in 2006, there were some gains among that the Democratic Party made. You know, let's face it, it was a bad year for Republicans. So Republicans lost votes among virtually all groups, and they lost some religious groups voters, and the Democrats picked up some of those votes. But the gap got bigger is because, despite this desire to shed their secularist image, they did even stronger, and they made bigger gains among the secular voters, where they won about 75% of their vote. And then it went up even bigger in 2008. So the idea. So what happened was there was the media from 2006 on began to report the closing of the gap, or the Democrats. This is what we found in, you know, the frames of the whatever stories appeared in our analysis of the religion gap or how the press was covering it. The new frames were, instead of, you know, Democrats have a religion problem or there's a religion gap, was Democrats are getting religion,
mm-hmm.
or the closing of the gap. And in 2008, the gap was much bigger than it was in 2004. But now the media is basically, and then in the 2010 election, they didn't even include a church attendance item that one that we could use to look at how significant the religion gap was, because their only interest was how religious people voted, you know, religious people versus everyone else. And that seems to be the chief preoccupation with the media, is what the religious people are up to. You know, they're the problem.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to think about that, as you just mentioned, that after 2004, the secular voters flocked to the Democratic Party. I can just see what's happening in the media, whereas the media is saying, oh, there's this big religious gap here, and the Democrats say, oh, we have to reach out and do outreach to religious voters. The seculars at the same time saying, oh, we didn't know that they were so secular, so we'll flock over there as well. So it's somewhat of an irony of this news coverage. And that's, I think, where I want to go now with what we're talking about in terms of this, because you've written a couple papers since the 2004 election and the 2004 spike in media coverage of this religion gap. And that is how the media affects the opinion of sophisticated opinion holders in and how they view fundamentalists. Now, what do you mean, first of all, by a sophisticated opinion holder?
Okay, I'm using a social science definition of sophisticated. I'm using ANES factual political information items like, do you know which party controls the House or the Senate, or what position Nancy Pelosi had, or who John Boehner has now, or who's Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Factual questions about party politics, who's in control of Congress, institutional operation. So you use that, and you construct a scale which basically you can use to find out how knowledgeable a person is about politics, and how attentive that person is in terms of following public affairs, and the extent to which is important, not only exposure to the information, but the extent to which they absorbed it or kept it. A person there's other items that are, how often do you read the news? And a person might indicate they read it every day, but still, they're exposed to, that Republicans have won the House, but they might not have absorbed it or forgot it. So we look at both ends, exposure and absorption. So we come up with a scale, and then we use that to look at people that are at the top end of that scale. We call the sophisticated. Now, what we were interested in, how do people form opinions of groups of individuals that they've never met? Mm-hmm. Because, let's face it, most people in New York or people living in Boston or out in L.A. or San Francisco never probably met a white evangelical or Christian fundamentalist.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that people have not met a individual from a group doesn't mean that they don't have opinions of that. And political scientist John Zoller says that, or he's done extensive research in this area, says that public opinion is essentially a marriage between information that important, that's contained in the media, attentiveness to the information environment, the news media, mm-hmm. and then your own predispositions, which determines how you're going to react to that. Now, my question, what my interest was, if a person never met an evangelical or a fundamentalist Christian, and their whole information was about members, these people, individuals, fundamentalists, was based on what they heard about in the media, what opinions would they form of them?
And what did you find?
Extremely negative.
Yeah.
It's obvious. Mm-hmm. They find them as extremely intolerant. They're much more likely to see them as intolerant than the ordinary people with ordinary levels of news consumption. They're more likely to place them on the far right. And what we do is we look at where fundamentalists stand on some of these points, and then we look at on like 7-point scales, and where then different types of people with different levels of political attentiveness place these, place the fundamentalists. And the sophisticated or the highly attentive tend to place them at the extreme ends of these scales, see them as wanting to keep women in the home, you know, like a 7 on ANES's 7-point women's role scale, whereas a 1 is, you know, would be that you want to see, you know, you'd like to see women out running for public office, running companies, and doing the same things basically as men, you know.
Right.
And fundamentalists score around a 2.9 on that scale, so they're not
surprisingly,
even
point.
So they're fairly, quote, feminist in their orientation. You know, not as feminist as, you know, as other groups, but they're certainly not 7s, you know, want to keep women in the home. And they place the fundamentalists on the far right. They think they're trying to, fundamentalists as individuals want to impose their values on the rest of society. And they just see them as basically, you know, as threatening to their, you know, values. And this is after controlling for the individual respondents' political ideology, partisanship, abortion position, attitudes towards gay. So you control for all that, and even when you hold constant all those other factors, the aware, politically sophisticated individual has a very negative opinion of Christian fundamentalists.
This is really interesting, too, because when we speak about sophisticated opinion, and both you and I are college professors, and so we hang out in these circles, and we have certain images of what the professoriate is like and also other elite opinion makers, there's this idea that, well, if you're a sophisticated opinion maker, you're able to weigh different opinions and think through this rather carefully. I mean, that would be the opposite theory of what is going on here, is that the sophisticated folks are able to get more at the truth because they're very good at evaluating alternative hypotheses and explanations for things. But it doesn't seem to actually be that way.
No. Well, for one thing, they're more likely to have been exposed to social science, classic social science studies, and studies in history, you know, Hofstadter studies, authoritarian personality. So they're exposed to an older literature that basically was very negative toward Christian fundamentalists and evangelicals. As Hofstadter reported that the evangelicals, you know, the spread of evangelicalism throughout America was like, was comparable to the spread of a virus or something like that. So that, you know, fairly negative. So they're more likely to have internalized Jefferson's wall of, you know, strict wall of separation, you know, church and state metaphor into their thinking. More likely to see classic movies like Inherit the Wind and you know, and things like that. So they've got this as their store of knowledge, and they're more likely to think that have very favorable impressions of the New York Times and Washington Post, and see them as where to get the news. And you know, if something is not, if the New York Times says something is news, then it's news. So
yeah,
if they say New York Times says the fundamentalists are intolerant, you know, that's where they get their views.
And we tend to circulate in those same circles, is that those folks who are reporters for the New York Times come to the social scientists for opinions.
They come to those that confirm. Probably might have had this experience that, you know, sometimes if a person from the press interviews me, they might totally disregard what I said and then take most of what I said and then take one bit of point I made and take it out of context and then seek out to validate what they are looking for from other political scientists. So there's that tendency, too.
Yeah, I have a funny little story about somebody calling me up to interview me about the Catholic Church's opinion toward Hugo Chavez in the past year or so, and he was quite surprised that the Catholic Church was coming out against Hugo Chavez because the Catholic Church and liberation theology has said that they're for the poor and stuff. And I basically said, no, this is not surprising at all, since, you know, Chavez is basically restricting a lot of their freedoms and such. And he the reporter couldn't understand that, and I eventually tracked down the article that he wrote and didn't cite me at all in saying that. So,
well, obviously, also the person was, you know, he was not all that aware of Catholicism, and didn't the Pope John Paul go over there, and he went after some Catholic priests for being heavily involved in this kind of, you know, left-wing activism.
And chastised Leonardo Boff and the likes of that. Let me talk about how this sophisticated opinion that we have, or that the sophisticated opinion generated from the media, and as you mentioned, you know, after this 2004 spike in coverage of the religious gap, this, you really see this effect playing out in the national election in subsequent national election surveys. So that coverage really did have some significant impact among the sophisticated or attentive users of the media. How does this play, if at all, into mass opinion or mass public opinion? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, people
yeah, you're less attentive.
The news a lot,
yeah, the less attentive folks, the people who don't
less
subscribe.
Attentive folks are not likely to hold, stereotypical opinions of Christian fundamentalists and evangelicals. I'm using non-fundamentalists. I'm not including
right.
the evangelicals and fundamentalists in this. So they have more benign views, and because they're so that's one thing. You know, they're kind of shielded from this. But there is a negativity even among ordinary people too. In other words, among all, if you look at attitudes towards the major religious groups in America and religious traditions, feelings toward fundamentalists and evangelicals overall is going to be more negative than more negative than toward other groups. That's one. It's kind of affected everyone. Because it's out there. You know, they might not have seen a newscast, but they've heard somebody at work talking about it or something. Or see a movie, you know, they're going to watch Saturday Night Live. They're going to catch a popular comedy movie that mocks and ridicules religious people. So it's still out there.
Yeah. You're watching the Daily Report or Colbert or something like that. It filters through.
Because, and that's become an important source of news for a lot of people.
So, we got a few minutes here, and just a chance for you to reflect a little bit upon your numerous research papers that you've written on this. What do you think are the broad implications of your research on this for religion and politics, for electoral politics, where our nation might be heading, or, you know, for other realms of life, say public policy and stuff? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I think that the country is divided over religion, you know, in a way that's different than in the past. It's not, you know, denominational, Catholic versus Protestant, but it's more, you know, secular, modernist versus traditionalist. But I see that it could get at least persist over time, because seculars as a force in the electorate are growing in number. You know, there's more and more people, especially among younger people, that are not attending church or not attaching themselves to religion. So there's a greater number of that end of the religious divide. And two, so you have one wing of the religious divide getting bigger, and two, the religious divide itself is connecting to a much broader range of issues than in the past. In the past, it might have been just limited to abortion, you know, cultural issues, and now it's expand. You know, the conflict or the divide is expanded into economic issues, foreign policy issues, even health care, and evaluations of presidents, and so on and so forth. So there's a potential that it could even get bigger. Also, the more that, you know, if people have a tendency to sort into parties on the basis of their perception of what the parties stand for, and if, you know, people could, you know, not all religious people are Republican, and not all seculars are Democrats, but maybe down the road you could find additional sorting, and so that could lead to more extensive polarization. But also, I'm interested in how another thing could be. If groups are perceived negatively, what happens when that group is associated with a public policy issue?
Yeah.
And will that lead people to oppose that policy?
Just because of the association.
Yeah, the negative reference. That's one of the areas that Jerry DeMeo and I are beginning to look at, is how negative, you know, you could oppose, you know, the role of religion public life, or vouchers, or opposition of vouchers. Antipathy toward evangelicals is turns up as a significant reason for why people might oppose vouchers in school, and also faith-based charities. Controlling for other things. What we found is interesting. Now, you could have had other reasons too. That these policies might violate separation of church and state, or they're divisive. All of these are reasons why people might oppose divisiveness, that they're in violation of, the wall of separation of church and state. But intensely disliking the group is a third reason. So, and I see this as a problem, and this is a tendency, and the Times even admitted to this in their self-study, the Siegel Report, or that they conducted a few years ago, is there the tendency of the Times to marginalize certain groups, and the only groups that they were talking about were religious Christians and fundamentalists, and then associate them with a particular policy. So if the people get the impression that the only people that are out there that oppose euthanasia or embryonic stem cell research or opposed to partial birth abortion or so, are fundamentalist Christians, basically fanatics and religious fanatics, then that kind of marginalizes even a an anti-partial birth abortion or a anti-euthanasia or anti-embryonic stem cell position, because it must be only nuts are opposed to these policies or favor those or whatever. That's the thing, is the linkage of a negative group to a policy, to a side in a public policy dispute.
Well, we're going to have to follow up on that in future podcasts here, because we are just about out of time. This has been a great discussion, and the implications for your research and where your research agenda is going is absolutely fascinating. For those of you who are out there listening to us, I would love to hear from you. Either you can email me directly at tgill@uw.edu, or you can participate in the discussion on our online discussion board, and we encourage you to do that. So, Lewis, it's been a great pleasure having you on, discussing all of this kind of stuff, and I'm sure we'll have you back on in the near future.
Well, it was nice talking to you and to your audience.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.